Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for October 2nd.
It's not really October 2nd when we're recording, but we're pre-recording.
It's the last day of September. Right. So we're ahead of the game because of our deep awesomeness. And because we did have a lot of things to say about an important topic, which was the death of Hugh Hefner, that auspicious moment in human history when another man dies, which I already wrote about this week, but it's interesting to see. I don't know, I've been thinking about it all week. What day did he die on? Wednesday.
I think Wednesday.
So I think it's interesting because you said a lot of men seem to have had pause, sort of stopped to reflect on
the He was kind of timeless, you know. Like he was timeless. He seemed anyway.
He seemed timeless.
Well, I mean, he always seemed to be enjoying his life and having walking around with the silk pajamas and the pipe and the captain's hat and
it's so weird.
Right? No, but he seemed that like he. So men who devote themselves to a life of license, I guess, he was kind of an icon, and his death is, you know,
interesting.
It is interesting because all the things that he pursued, he got everything. He's a person who got everything he wanted out of life, everything he wanted, and then he died.
Yeah.
And he still died. He died.
Now
face to face with his maker. Well, I'm not sure how long that lasted, but
probably not long.
right.
It's probably right. Not still face to face.
Right. So I mean, it's very solemn. It's very, you know, ecclesiastical, I guess, not church wise, but
Ecclesiastes.
Like the book.
You know, so the children and I are memorizing Ecclesiastes 12 this fall. That's our passage that we're memorizing, and I read it out as usual on Thursday morning. And it was really interesting to read it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like it was written for him or for any person who goes throughout their life without thinking about their creator. The description of death is so interesting in Ecclesiastes 12. But it was sort of a solemn reading of that passage, which is interesting because Solomon wrote it,
mm-hmm.
who had a life that probably from outward appearances looked to be as perfect as Hugh Hefner's, honestly.
If you had all the power in the world and all the money in the world, what would you do? And Solomon did.
He did what?
Ever his heart desired.
Yeah.
He could. I mean, few of us have the power to do whatever our hearts desire, but he. Or the means, he had both.
And the thing that he regretted then was that he wasn't a peasant in a hut
working
with
hard.
His one wife.
Yeah.
That's what he wished he could have had.
Yeah. What's better in life but to work with your hands, enjoy your food and your drink and the wife of your youth. And there's this kind of... That's what he wishes he'd had. Not the kingdom, not the women, not the building projects, not the everything that he put his hands to. He got. I mean, everything he desired, he got. But it was empty in the end. It was dust. And that's it's not a inaccurate comparison to compare Hugh Hefner with Solomon, because at least in his pursuit of women, Solomon probably outdid him.
Yeah.
Actually. With his harem, and yet at the end it seems Solomon came to repentance. Not so sure about Hugh Hefner.
Yeah, I mean, well, Solomon said, "Return to the wisdom of his youth," whereas it seems like Hugh Hefner never had any to begin with, and so he had nothing to go back to.
Well, he was raised a Methodist, though.
It didn't seem like that was a real thing, though.
Yeah,
like
they were
Methodists,
right.
Well, they were. I think they were devout, but they, as so many Christian parents, did not communicate the substance of their faith to him, except to be rigid. And
right.
So the thing that really appalled me is that in the long, long article that I linked, one reason why he was interested in bunnies was because he had a blanket with bunnies on it as a child. He never went past childhood, essentially. He just imported license into his own. He didn't progress. He didn't grow up. He didn't. He just was a child and adolescent forever. Mm-hmm. Which I think is what many people think that they would like.
To live like that. Well, I know many men look at that and thought.
Back.
Oh,
I see. If I didn't have to deal with reality, if I didn't have to deal with the reality of people, real people, then I would be happy. It's other people that make life so difficult and bad.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've been reading a ton about stress lately because, I don't know, stress impacts a lot of different things. And a lot of secular advice on stress is to just get away from stressful people. If you just get rid of stress, then, which is other people, then you'll be happy,
mm-hmm.
and you will live a long time. So mm-hmm. get away from this is kind of what Joel Osteen says, get away from the negative people in your life, and then you'll be happy, which I think is a sort of, you know, it's the anti-marriage of Hugh Hefner. I will craft everybody around me.
Yeah, he didn't get away from people. He just created people.
He forced them not to be people.
Right.
And that way he was happy. He always had this huge smile on his face.
His quote-unquote girlfriends were like the... He gave them... He let them live in his mansion for free, right? They had free rent. They got an allowance of $1,000 a week. But in exchange, they had to be exactly who Hugh Hefner wanted them to be,
yeah,
in every way, and they couldn't. He gave them very strict rules about how they lived, who they saw, what they were supposed to do on a given day, and so you're right. He had a stress free life because he just
He looked stress free. He looked relaxed.
He constructed his social world based on his own desires, and it's really not that different from what, you know, a man or a woman does at home with their computer and their social media life. They construct little communities of people who they want to be around and who are either always affirming or always just the kind of people they and things they want to see. And so, but really doesn't it's inherently narcissistic. You're living out a mirror image of your own passions in every realm. And it's lonely and it's sad. And I don't know if he was ever lonely.
Yeah, I don't think he was lonely or sad, looking at it from the outside, it looks lonely and sad. And the thing that I think is saddest, because I've read that long article, is that he acknowledged that he never met anybody. He was never in love with somebody who he deemed his soulmate, which I would say...
Soulmates? Are you even other soulmates?
I don't believe in soulmates necessarily, but he...
He never felt...
He might have met somebody who he could have felt a deep emotional connection to, mm-hmm. but he didn't allow that possibility because he never... allowed anybody to be a human,
right.
You know, this is not far away from ending up with sex bots.
Yeah,
you know, you craft another person into to not be who they are, but he couldn't be happily married, or he couldn't be a happy person in love with the euphoria of actual love, which requires that you let the other person be who they are,
right.
And discover who they are, which is what marriage is.
Right.
Lifelong marriage. So, you know, being inside of a marriage, I look out at that and think, well, that's sad. That's pathetic. Although somebody commented on my Facebook page, who are you to judge?
Someone said that.
Yeah. And I'm going to write back and say, I can judge because I'm living a better life than he did.
That's not why you can judge, because you're pretty wicked too. Not in that way, but you're wicked.
Well, I can judge because I've got the scriptures.
There you go, right.
But also my experience of life is better than his, objectively.
Well, right. You do have the being surrounded by people that you've constructed and made to be exactly who you want them to be, who you're having sexual relations with all the time. You do have that. You're not that person. So you do have that plank out of your eye. You could you can then turn and notice the plank in Hugh Hefner's eye, but
I'm not noticing.
So that's true. Is that what you mean?
Not what I mean. No, I don't. I'm not looking at the plank in his eye. I'm saying it's okay. You can look at other people and see the pathological sadness of their lives,
right,
and not crow or rejoice. Right. But one way that I can know that it's sad is because of
the marriage that we have.
Yeah,
The
weight of glory thing is so great because Lewis says he brings up pornography. It's like a little boy playing in the mud who doesn't know that there's a nice ice cream inside.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't know. He thinks he's happy. He thinks he's got everything he wants, and mm-hmm. he can't go. If he would go inside, he would see what's waiting for him. So it's good to look at that and say that's foolishness, that's mm-hmm. vanity, that's, you should put that aside and go and find a person who you can connect to in a deep emotional way over time, in all the changeability and mm-hmm. difficulty of human relationships.
Like, he knew lots of women, but he never really knew a woman, and he didn't know. I mean, I think,
and so he was never known.
Right.
He himself was never known then, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think you were saying that maybe it was in your article, but how he probably was really looking in some level he didn't know for genuine affection and genuine.
Yeah,
someone who really loved him.
It just didn't happen for him. You know, somehow it escaped him because the circumstances weren't right, or the stars didn't align. That's the way he talks. Well, fate didn't allow.
Right, but.
But actually.
But he was looking for it in the sex, and he was looking for it in the life he was constructing for himself, and not, because was it you who was writing this? No, his parents really weren't affectionate with him, and so he didn't know. I'm not saying that explains why everything, but it was, his parents weren't affectionate with him, and he never really had the kind of a foundational relationship in his life, not just with, in a romantic sense, but even in a, like with parents.
A familial sense.
Yeah. So there was no pattern for him to go on to construct something like that.
But then he had sort of brilliance. He was able to build an empire with an intelligence at an adolescent boy level, mm-hmm. emotional level.
Yeah.
Which is so crazy. Well, no, and there we are. I mean, our whole culture is stuck at the level of Hugh Hefner, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, absolutely. So, I mean, but the guys look at, so one question people often ask is, who are Christians or not Christians, or my life is so horrible. Like, I'm having relationship problems. My job's not going where I want it to go. I'm probably going to die in obscurity and with not a lot of money. And I feel that's not fair because I'm a pretty good person. I go to church. I read my Bible. I do good things. I know I'm a sinner, but I'm not horrible. And then there's this guy like Hugh Hefner who's awful. And he has everything he wants. He doesn't have to worry about money. He doesn't have to worry about finding women. He doesn't have to worry about cars. He has everything he wants. Well, how is that fair? And then that's the Psalms question, right? The Psalmist's question. And
yeah, why are the wicked spreading out like a green bay tree? And I'm here in my hovel about to starve to death.
Right.
And my children are perishing from hunger. And where is God?
Mm-hmm. And with the... what that person who asked that question sees ultimately is how slippery the walk is for the person who has everything he wants. And one slip and he dies and he goes to face his maker.
He still dies.
Yeah,
the wicked die. The righteous man dies.
Yeah. And so it's kind of it's a mercy. It's a real mercy that God does not give Christians everything they want. It's a mercy that we don't have the power to use the way that Hugh Hefner had it to use. We don't have the money to use the way Hugh Hefner, because we might use things in a way that will destroy our souls.
Yeah. Well, we definitely will.
Yeah. So God's being merciful and sometimes making us poor and making us not
sick
and not have the ability to do. It's just kind of like, well, are you going to let your 11-year-old drive the car?
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to. The next door neighbors let the 11-year-old drive the car. Well, that's because they don't love their children.
Yeah.
And God loves his children, so he gives them what they're able to handle as far as, and not destroy themselves with.
The being stricken by God and afflicted, I mean, it's such a difficult thing for a Christian to see that happening to another Christian or to themselves, and perceiving it as the good that it is. You know, when God brings you really low and mm-hmm. strikes you, and you're left weak and mm-hmm. impoverished and in trouble, and you then can see your Creator, you can remember your Creator at that point. That is such an incredible act of love. So I said this to some, maybe I said it to you, but the thing that was really interesting to me to watch this all week, because you were reading about the impact of Hugh Hefner on the culture and on the lives of men and the destruction of families. But the contrasting image for me between Hugh Hefner and the men of that I know, Christian men in our church and in my family and my life, who have been stricken by God, who have had things taken away, who maybe live in unhappy but faithful marriages, who have struggled to make a living, who don't always have the car that they want or any car, and how how much those men go along caring for people.
Yeah.
You know, there's people at our church who go and pick up other people to bring them to church. Difficult people.
Yeah.
Who you wouldn't really maybe want in your, you know, in your perfect life. The people that are,
you wouldn't choose to be friends with if you were choosing your friends.
If you were choosing your friends, but they would get, or other, take them shopping and to doctor's appointments, and who bear with each other and who care for the needs of the downcast and the small, and they do it without complaint, you know, without narcissism. And if you thank them, they get irritated with you and they blow you off. I mean, there are a lot of men. I know men, real men like that. It's really interesting. I just spent a lot of time looking at those people and then looking at the pictures of Hugh Hefner and how different, alarmingly different they are. How real, how mm-hmm. grown up.
Mm-hmm.
And actually feeling encouraged by the number of people I know, young men who've had their lives impacted ultimately, maybe not by Playboy particularly, but by porn, which
mm-hmm,
was the,
mm-hmm.
but who have fought, struggled, battled their way back from that to adulthood and marriage,
mm-hmm.
and to honor and know a woman and other people. And I was really encouraged by that, you know. I mean, God, it's dire. It's absolutely dire, and the church is beset. But there are people in the church today who God is...
That's our dog licking. So it's not one of us, it's the dog.
I'm not licking myself. I don't know. I'm really encouraged.
Yeah.
You know, it's not hundreds and millions, maybe, but God isn't...
I mean, you talk to guys who are Christian.
Abandoned
who are single and who are struggling with pornography and failing often, falling into it often. And they look at it, they're the thing, and they think, well, there's no way I can ever get out of this. I'm enslaved. I've made myself a slave, and I can't.
Yeah, I can't get
unslave myself, and that's true. You can't. But what's interesting in Good Shepherd, we've seen a number of guys, is like you say, God has, over time. It's not an immediate thing usually.
It's very slow. It's very painful.
Just pulling them out of the pit.
Yeah.
Getting them into a marriage, or getting them at least where they're okay by themselves, and not. Always.
And you can see the
difference in their eyes and in the way they look and talk.
The rescue, I mean, the incredible rescue of God, and the mercy, you know, because a lot of them continue to be beset by grief. Mm-hmm. You know, they continue to be afflicted by God and various material considerations. But that is such a mercy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such a loving action of God to rescue them.
Yeah.
And bring them into the joy of an actual relationship with an actual woman.
Right.
In other words, God isn't dead, even though I think it can feel like it. I mean, the force of Hugh Hefner across this culture is something that can't even be measured.
What was once in the dark corners.
And known to be wrong,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And to take it out and call it good.
Mm-hmm.
That's utterly devastating.
Mm-hmm. And but it's an attractive lie to a young man. It's an attractive lie. You want to believe it. You really want to believe that. It's okay. It's not bad. It's not like, you know, Playboy, for example, wasn't like, you know, really hardcore pornography. It's just like playing around. It's nothing. It's just I'm a guy. I like looking at women who don't have clothes on, and
it's fine.
It's fine. It's no big deal. But
it's not hurting anyone.
Yeah, it's not hurting anyone. But it really does put you in that place where your mind about what a woman is has been fundamentally shifted. Your understanding of your own drive is now keyed in on satisfaction rather than the fullness of what it was supposed to do. I mean, I was reading a book about sex and a marriage as covenant reaffirmation. Like when you come together sexually with your wife, your husband, if you're a woman, you're reaffirming, reconsummating the vow that you had together. So it's not just about two people having their needs met physically. It's there's this breadth to it that may not be totally understood every time you have sex, but there's a fullness to married sex between married covenanted people that is just gone when you reduce a person to her body. Sometimes.
Or not even her real body.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a cut and shaped and crafted and sculpted and weird,
right?
You know, you she's not allowed to be who she is or would have been. She's not allowed to break. She's not allowed to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And because the female body is, if it's gonna have children, is gonna be irrevocably in this life altered and broken and destroyed in some sense. And that's not allowed, you know, if it's about you and you not being known and she not being known.
Well, another thing I think is weird is, you know, Hugh Hefner kind of broke that ground for men. Not only is it okay to look at women undressing or whatever, it's a normal, totally cool thing to do.
It's good for you, even.
Yeah, it's good for you, but that's kind of happened for women too, hasn't it? With 50 Shades of Grey, and the old school feminists really were hating on Hugh Hefner, but then it's now become like this a mark of feminist liberation that you can read 50 Shades of Grey and be titillated just like a man. Is that...
Don't, you keep asking me that like I know.
I don't know. I'm just, when
you, not going to read that book.
I don't want you to read that book. I'm just saying if you talk... Is that what it seems like? But when you read women talking about Fifty Shades of Grey, it's an act of liberation, isn't it? When they talk, when they write their articles about it, they're...
Well, I think it... It's a, I don't know, maybe like the Sex and the City, you know, yeah, the Sex yeah, and the City, I mean. The women in New York City living the life of Hugh Hefner, having men and throwing them away.
Yeah.
Is the pinnacle of human achievement for them. They've arrived. They've gotten everything they wanted.
And now you're just like a man.
Yeah, now you're just like a man.
You're as free as he is. And of course, the man's a slave.
Yeah.
And now you've become a slave too. You've made your...
It's awful.
Right.
So, well, I don't really want to... I said this... This is too big. I shouldn't talk about it. The futility of keeping house and having children, the sense of horror, like I can't believe that I'm stuck in this house taking care of these people, is a similar kind of horror of a man. What do you mean I should just be with one person forever? That's absurd. How will I be happy? You know, there's a...
Yeah.
I'm going to write about that later.
And look at her. She's getting older. Or look at her.
Yeah, I should truck her.
Yeah, look at her. She's not like she was when she was 20 when we first got married. And there's this... Right, so there's the male who's not... doesn't understand the purpose of marriage, really. That's when, if he has the means...
He gets a divorce.
Or if he doesn't have the means, he starts... He pornography becomes something again, right? So this one woman is not who I want to be with, so... But I have options.
Yeah, I can look at whatever I want, whoever I want, whenever I want. Yeah. It's really tragic.
Right, and the whole thing, one thing that we've been saying is that about one of the things we've noticed in our marriage is how if you just cut that option off at the beginning, there's no other person that I'm going to be with, there's no other person that I'm going to desire, I'm going to ask God to help me not desire any other person, then there's depths that you go to, in every aspect of your relationship that can't be understood until you go there.
Yeah.
You can't grasp how good it is until you purposely discipline yourself and limit yourself to your union.
Which is such a risk. Right. I mean, right. That's why people don't do it, because it's a terrible risk. The other person could die or get sick. Or leave you, mm-hmm. you know, and so you could end up unhappy and alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the risk for many is too great.
Yeah.
To say I will have no other person in visually or in reality or in any other way. I will only be with this one person, mm-hmm. and emotionally too. You know, like you won't have deep. Conversational relationships with other people. You won't, you know, go cook with other women. You won't go do anything with other people. Your relationship will be so singular that the outsider will look in and think that's absurd.
Yeah.
That's dysfunctional and bad.
Right. Yeah.
It's an incredible risk. I think people just calculate that it's not worth it. And so, because they don't know, they might have an idea that the rewards are great, but they can't be sure.
You see it like, even in Christian couples, you see it where we've had people who've attempted to be friends with us who would rather be friends with one of us rather than the other. And they, because usually it's because they in their own marriage can't fathom being really best friends with each other. So they're trying to find, so they'll try to peel me off or peel you off.
Yeah.
And surely you'd rather be my friend than be with your husband all the time. Surely you'd rather be my friend than be with your wife all the time. You've got to have a real male friend. You've got to have a real female friend. And yeah, we do have male female friends, but they can't replace the marriage friendship that's the primary one. And that's hard for some people to get, I think. It's hard for people who are in, who've never really seen marriage that way to understand.
If marriage is just sort of an estate that you're in and yeah. you're just in it, you know, you have children and you have your jobs and you have your life, but you haven't really clung on to each other, and so you can sort of scatter the emotional energy and the, you know, in other places, and not gather it and focus it in all difficulty and in all, you know, mundane ordinariness. You end up not really getting the fullness of what you what's on offer, what's promised. So you should do that. You should try. You should focus in. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have, you know.
Your best friendship should be the one in your marriage. Yeah,
but if you're, you should also shouldn't, you know, you should really battle back the porn addiction, even if you're, even in marriage.
Yeah. Yes.
Because you're, you're missing out.
Especially in marriage.
Yeah. Well, especially in marriage. Yeah. I mean, you're really missing out if you don't.
Focus.
Yeah, focus all of your energy on one person only.
If you, so how would you? It's kind of a side issue, but you know, getting out of it is hard. So, what we found at Good Shepherd is one of the first and best ways to get out of it is to confess it. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to the whole world necessarily, but you go to your pastor, go to another man who's not maybe or who's struggled with it before, and maybe even still struggling with it, and start talking to him. We have a group of men who meet at our church, who have either come out of it or who are still in it but trying to get out of it, and that's proved hugely helpful. I mean, everyone who's really successfully gotten out of that at Good Shepherd has gone through something like that.
It's not. There's no gimmick. There's no I'm gonna do these
50-day program.
Yeah.
It's
hard. It's years long. Yeah. It's difficult, but mm-hmm. it's really good. I mean, it makes everybody happier. The people who go through it end up being happy in the way that is promised by the lie. You know, you end up getting to have the thing that you
really wanted.
And ultimately, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, that's our advice. That's our marital advice.
Don't watch porn.
Don't watch porn.
Right. Don't.
Don't be Hugh Hefner. If you have a
stack of Playboys under your bed, just.
I think that's old fashioned.
Right. Yeah, I guess it would be because you don't need a stack anymore. You have the internet. But whatever. Internet. Get rid of all.
Get rid of the internet. Yeah. Better to turn off your internet connection forever.
Than to deal with that.
Than to lose your immortal soul forever. Mm-hmm. That's the modern. Mm-hmm. Better to cut off your right hand, mm-hmm. or gouge out your eye.
Better not have internet.
Better to have no internet.
Right.
At all.
Right.
Than to lose your soul forever.
But also remember, as Christians, Jesus died for the sin. So there's a in the Christian life, there's the besetting sin that you're stuck in. And how does a Christian deal with that? You know, a Christian, you're right. There's radical action to take, but there's also you remember the cross, because you just continually, when you fail, go to the cross and receive that forgiveness, because that way you don't. Guilt tends to only exacerbate sin.
Yeah.
It doesn't cure it. I mean, feeling really guilty about something doesn't fix the problem. Only forgiveness does, and grace. And
that's a good point on that. Having feeling bad about your feelings isn't gonna make it better. So if you feel a certain way, that's fine. Just don't worry about that right now. Just go back to Jesus over and over and over again, and what you know to be true. And the feelings will ultimately sort themselves out, including the lust. The lust mm-hmm. will be tempered and brought into order, the God's good order.
Yeah.
But if you berate yourself for how you feel.
Right. Well, it's a problem. First John chapter 1, 8, 9, 10. If you say you have no sin, you deceive yourself. But if you confess your sins, he is faithful and just to forgive you, that's one, and cleanse you, right? So the confessing and going back to God every single time you fall is an act by which God, or through which God, actually begins to cleanse you and, of course, forgive you, but cleanse you too. So it's a cleansing.
You do end up doing the sin less and having a better life and mm-hmm. more actual happiness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Well, we solved that. I mean, if you just follow our plan, you will have a great life.
Right.
You'll have your best life now and later. That's have your best life later.
Yeah.
Just do that. Don't have your best life now. And I'm sure we'll be back with more important advice.
We've got to get some decorative gourds out of our attic.
That's right. It's people.
Right. I mean, the cornucopia of decorative gourds.
We need to get that thing on the front door now. And the pumpkin spice. Because it's finally not 165 degrees. Right. It's like 60 degrees.
It feels like fall. Right.
Yeah, we've got stuff to do. So we'll be back next week.